Welcome to Inside Sponsorship, the show that provides sponsorship professionals with advice, insights, and news so they can maximize their commercial programs and achieve best practice.
Welcome to Inside Sponsorship Episode 8. I'm Daniel Oyston, your host. Thanks for joining me, whatever it is you're doing. Colin Maguire is the CEO at Touch Football Australia, which is the official body for touch football, and it is the role of the organisation to develop and grow the sport of touch football in Australia. For those listeners not familiar with the sport, it is similar to rugby league but without the tackling. There are a bunch of other different rules, however, not least of which is the size of the field and the number of players, and the fact that because it's non-contact, it can be played as a mixed sport and even a family sport. It has grown from humble beginnings into a sport that in Australia boasts 400,000 registered members and an additional 500,000 children participating in school programs and related activities. And as such, it is placed among the top participant-based organised sports in Australia. Now, almost 3 years ago, Touch Football Australia and the National Rugby League announced an historic strategic partnership. And how that partnership has affected Touch Football Australia's commercial program is the key focus of my chat with Colm. But before we hear from Colm, I sat down for my regular chat with Mark Thompson. Mark and I have been discussing for a little while about the process of bedding down a new sponsor and what advice we can give people to help make the signing of a new sponsor successful. As such, Mark and I discussed his recent blog, which provides a 7 checkpoint roadmap you can follow once you've signed a new sponsor. Here's Mark.
So we're recording this a week earlier than we normally are because you're going to Fiji.
Work. For work.
You think you've earned a break?
I've definitely earned a break.
And will you be seeing Fiji rugby while you're over there in between cocktails and massages?
Not sure. Just exchanging notes with Tony Thorpe at the moment, so hopefully.
So we've got you on the show this week because a reasonably regular occurrence with our listeners is signing a new sponsor. And it's always a good feeling after, you know, lots of hard work and conversations, and you look great in front of the boss because you've been telling them that this sponsor's coming, and there's lots of backslapping and congratulations and things like that. But really, it's your next moves that will probably dictate the long-term success of that relationship, correct?
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, so, I mean, basically, as you just said, the first couple of weeks after you sign a new partnership, everybody's excited, everybody's highly engaged. You'll actually probably never have a more engaged sponsor than when they first sign, because, you know, you're meeting their new staff, they're excited about a new project to manage this partnership. You know, they've obviously undergone a bit of change in their organisation to take on a new property to sponsor as part of their marketing strategy. So everybody's highly engaged. So there are a few things that you can do in that highly engaged period which will really make the difference between having a streamlined, easy approach to that partner going forward, or, you know, continually chasing your tail and possibly even straining the relationship down the track.
Okay, great. So you've put together a roadmap with 7 checkpoints for people to follow to help ensure that success. Number one seems pretty straightforward. It's exchange the contact details.
Yeah, and it's not just as simple, though, as just exchanging email and phone numbers of one or two people. You've got to kind of drill down a little bit deeper. You'll have a day-to-day sponsorship manager in most cases, somebody that you'll talk to day in, day out for the delivery of benefits. But they'll also have a CEO, a finance manager. You need just to understand who are the point of contacts for the different activities that you're going to play throughout the relationship. So, you know, who is to be invited by your CEO to certain functions? Is it their chairman or is it their CEO? Who do you send invoices to? Direct to finance, or do you send it to the sponsorship manager? Just setting out a list of contacts, and vice versa. You know, if they want to, in a sporting context, for example, if they want to organise player appearances as part of their arrangement, they may not necessarily go directly through the sponsorship manager. They may have to go through the team manager, and depending on how your organisation is structured, sharing all those contact details as well.
All right, so that's checkpoint one. Checkpoint two is exchange IP details.
Yeah, so swap all logos. This is actually just a time-saving exercise because, you know, when time comes that you need to get logos off a partner, it's often in really time-critical situations where you've got a publication due, or, you know, there's a deadline to go to publish. So, you know, if you have all the different pre-approvals and all the different correct logos to the right sizes early on, then it's just a matter of getting off the checked off by the sponsor the use of the logo. They're not going to, you know, you're 99% sure they're not going to come back with changes, which sets back your deadline. But it's not just, again, getting one logo, you know, different sizes for your different uses, your
and
website.
And different formats, like .eps and .ai, in case you need to send it for a big screen or signage or something like
exactly
that.
Exactly right. And because JPEGs and PNGs are quite easily to come, you know, come by. But I would say that, you know, especially with the amount of different, platforms that you use now, you need specific size copies for Facebook. You need different sizes for your website, different sizes for your app platform, things like that.
And even some sponsors have different orientations of their logos. With ours at Sponsor, we have a square one, but we also have a landscape long skinny one, depending on what format things need to go in. So make sure you got copies of all of that.
Exactly. And if you're printing stuff on your apparel or uniforms and stuff like that, you're going to have, you know, depending on the placement, some will want their stacked logo if it's a sort of a front center type thing. And if it's in a collar or something like that, they may want the landscape version.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's important to get those different versions, because if you're not very, design skilled up, you might need one with a transparent background, where we know JPEGs are always white, and you go and drop it somewhere and you're like, oh no, that doesn't look any good.
A lot of big brands will have a style guide. And if you've got that, that'll outline how you use the logos in which different scenarios. But it's also important to share designation terminology that you want used about each other. So as a rights holder, you may want people to say, you know, we are proud partners of X organisation, of yourselves. And so that's what they are aware, that how they can reference you when they're talking about their partnership. And similarly, do they have naming rights to you guys? You know, are you called the Sponsor of Hawks, or what is their designation? Are they the exclusive supplier of medical equipment?
And on that point, the checkpoint number two is exchange IP details, but that's, we've only spoken about getting everything else. It's probably important for you to give them all the various copies of your logos and wording and things like that.
And even, you know, I know in sport, under the collective bargaining agreements, there's certain rules around the amount of players you can use in an image and stuff like that. So, you know, in rugby, it was or is 4 players per image that a partner can use. So it's almost, clever to have a suite of different images that you can share with different partners so that they're not all using the same image.
Yep. Number three, so I've gone through checkpoint two. Number three is share a calendar of events.
Yeah, so this works both ways. So ensure they've got a full copy of your calendar. And what I used to do was also then highlight any event that they received benefits at. So they have the full calendar of events that they receive, you know, from me, which outlines everything that we were doing through the year. But then I'd just highlight in a different colour or something, this is where you actually have benefits at. So it stands out to them that they've got a job to do around activating and taking advantage of the properties that they've got access to. And then, you know, vice versa, finding out what they've got on in their world around any milestone dates. You know, they may be having an anniversary, a special product launch, a rebrand, things like that that you just, it's handy to know about, because not only do you maybe want to be there so you can network to their customers and you know, all of their sort
of stuff. Or
even
if you can just help them in any way, you know, can you bring this or do that or just be there and say hello?
But also knowing why and when they're going to be busy, because if they've got a massive event on and then you're pressuring them to get you stuff, then there's going to be a clash. So actually knowing, you know, geez, they haven't returned my phone call, rather than getting paranoid that they're disengaging, just having a look at their calendar going, oh, actually they're in, you know, Singapore at a product launch.
Mm. And importantly, checkpoint four is set a schedule of catch-up. So you can probably use that calendar of events as a bit of a talking point when you're catching up. But what should we do with setting regular catch-ups?
Well, it's actually a little bit unconventional. Not many people actually sit down at the start and go, let's set an expectation that we catch up this many times per month. It might be, you know, phone, you know, we'll call you every week and run through our benefits to make sure you delivered it, which we've heard some stories about. But, you know, what I'm talking about here is actually catching up with your partner in a meaningful way, you know, going to see them once a quarter or, you know, if you've got a sort of an event on around your, you know, where you reside, then, and they're coming to it, setting some time before or after that to sit down and just catch up with them, just talk to them. Basically, you do this mainly for your major partners, but having that sort of expectation that you've got to have monthly or bi-monthly or quarterly catch-ups helps you preset those times, set it aside from the outset, calendarize it so it doesn't actually fall off your radar. Because I mean, we spoke about this early on in our blog series. That's a sort of, sometimes it's viewed upon as a nice to have, or we're going out for a coffee with someone, but it's actually really important to building a concrete base for that.
Absolutely. Relationship. And getting those catch-ups in your diary, you then invite the other person, obviously, so it's in their diary and they can work things around it. But then yep. you don't have to meet if you mutually agree.
Yep.
You know, you might accidentally set them too often early on in the relationship, but it's much better to have them in the diary and take them out than trying to find time in the diary, because sometimes you might spend all week thinking, oh, I should go and see the sponsor next week, I should go and see the sponsor next week. Gets a Thursday, Friday, you get in contact, they're like, no, I'm away for 2 weeks or yeah. I haven't got time. And then a couple of days of you thinking about getting in contact with the sponsor turns into a month. And it's not a good way to manage your relationship. So yeah, no, put them in the diary and then take them out if you don't need them.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that.
All right, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Set reminders and record deliverables. Who's not doing that?
Yeah, well, actually, people are recording deliverables because you need to fulfill. But one thing people don't do is have a method of knowing what is to be delivered at certain times. Normally, it's a last minute scramble through, a WIP document or something like that to see what you have and haven't done. What I'm talking about here is schedule reminder, so it actually comes to you to tell you what needs to be done. It's easily accessible. You know, when you're in a busy space or you know, something unforeseen happens, you don't forget to do the little things. And it might just be little things. It might be, you know, sending them a recommendation or, you know, some sort of a testimonial from your strength and conditioning coordinator about their product. But if you don't do it, that's going to impact on your relationship.
Absolutely, and particularly around those deliverables that aren't event-based or time-based. It's just a player, one player appearance, or you know, one jersey.
Yep.
They're easy things to fall off your radar.
But you know, one really big miss that we see all the time, and we hear it a lot from our big partners who help their sort of affiliates to manage their partners, is forgetting to invoice people.
Mm.
So they get stuck in the day-to-day grind of delivering benefits, but actually forget to get the money. So, you know, setting a payment schedule with your finance team where it reminds you to send invoices is...
And particularly if you're a small rights holder and you might have a lot of local businesses as your partners, they've often got tight cash flow as well. They don't want to be getting three invoices at once because you forgot to do it. It's not only poor form, it hurts a relationship, but it's pretty unprofessional.
Yeah, exactly right.
Number 7, make a welcome pack.
Number 6 is...
did I miss 6?
Yeah, make a note of partnership objectives.
That's important.
Yeah, that's probably more important than making a welcome pack.
All right, let's go back one because you get fined points if you miss a checkpoint in the roadmap. So number 6 is make a note of the partnership objectives. I agree, that's pretty important.
It's probably definitely not the least important objective.
Lucky you've written a roadmap for me.
Well, and it's actually funny how you've just missed that, because I do write it's certainly not the least important step in the, it's the first line of my blog. But, you know, these objectives basically can sit there so that they are top of mind for you. So this isn't benefits. This isn't making a list of all the benefits. This is, why does the partner want to partner with you? What objectives are they trying to achieve by partnering with you?
So they're things like what? Community engagement, networking, brand awareness, qualified leads,
brand positioning,
yep.
Networking, things like that. So knowing what those objectives are will help you to add additional value to your partners. So ensuring that benefits are delivered and focused on these areas, and so you can deliver benefits in different ways, remember. So if they have player appearances and it's all about brand positioning, try and encourage them to use those player appearances to drive their brand and align their brand with you, rather than just taking their players off to a kid's birthday party or something. So that's a really key one. But also when you've got additional assets or unused inventory and you're looking to value add to a partner, if they're looking for brand positioning and you give them free tickets, whilst that seems on the surface like awesome, we get free tickets, we can take our staff and family and friends and they'll feel good, and the person you give the tickets to will feel really good. At the end of the day, from a business viewpoint, if when they're sitting back and looking at it from the end of the year or halfway through the year or however often you do your fulfillment reporting, those tickets aren't going to help drive their objective to why they're partnering with you.
No, and two important points to make for the listeners there is it's okay to give them tickets that don't, if that benefit doesn't align with any objectives,
yep.
But it gives you an opportunity to help keep the objectives top of mind with them and say, look, I know you won't. I know one of your objectives aren't community engagement, but I've got some spare tickets. Would you like them? It helps keep the objectives in the conversation. And also, if you've got the objectives top of mind and you're meeting with them on regular occasions and you're talking objectives, just weaving them into the conversation all the time, we know that sometimes the objectives of a business change during a partnership, and that keeps it top of mind to talk about, can we adjust anything? Because our objectives have changed where we want to focus more on community or less on networking or whatever it is, rather than finding out when it comes to renewal time and their objectives and their business have changed and they say to you, it didn't really meet our objectives because you didn't record them at the start. You didn't know them.
And it might be that you call them and offer them tickets and go, look, we know that your key objectives are more around positioning your brand, but we've got some spare tickets. Do you want them? And they may say, you know what, our churn rates have been really high the last few months, so we're changing our focus to be on customer engagement. So those tickets would really help.
Yeah, and even if you have those objectives top of mind, you might come up with some of those ideas. So they might have, I don't know, qualified leads. You might have some tickets and think, well, that's not going to help necessarily with qualified leads. But you could say, hey, I've got some spare tickets. I know qualified leads are part of your objectives. Do you want the tickets? Maybe you could run a competition on social media to gather email addresses and help build a database.
Exactly. Like, so that's
you just stand out so much then from the other rights holders that they're dealing with.
Yeah, I mean, that's a totally other conversation around whose responsibility is it these days to help activate. And, that is leaning into the rights holder, helping drive that activation, but I'm actually a believer of that.
Yeah, cool. Okay, number seven, I finally got there. Had to do a U-turn to six, but I've gone through six, went through that gate. Number seven's welcome pack.
Yep, so basically it's just almost a checklist pack for your partner, outlining everything we've just spoken about that you want from them or you need from them to get off on the right foot. It does a couple of things. It shows your sponsor that you're well organized and efficient, which will fill them with confidence that their money's being well spent. But also what it does is show them that you'll help guide them through this whole process. You're not there just to call out and go, hey, I need some money or I need a logo, give it to me.
What sort of stuff are you putting in this thing?
Into the welcome pack? Or literally just to welcome on board, maybe some sort of a nice message from the CEO or something like that. You don't even need to be that serious. It may just be, welcome aboard. Here's all of our IP, images, logos, all of that.
Maybe on a nice USB.
Yeah, something like that. But we need this back from you in return. And this will, and outline why. You don't just say, here's this, give us something back. That's just a transaction.
Yep.
Put a bit of a, blurb around why you need certain things and how it's going to help. And, basically ask them for, these sorts of things because of these reasons. And if things change, please, make sure we know. Even when it comes to the contact details and stuff, you might want to just send them a template to populate. Just make life easy for them, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. And it's also, they don't think that just because they're signed on the dotted line and then you disappear for a month or so. Okay, so going through those again, number one, exchange contact details. Number two, exchange IP details. Number three, share a calendar of events. And those three are all both ways. You've got to get stuff. You've also got to give stuff to them.
Yep.
Set a schedule of regular catch-ups. Set reminders and record the deliverables, so make sure nothing falls off the radar. Number six, don't miss number six. Make a note and keep the partnership objectives top of mind and create a welcome pack. And so if people follow those seven checkpoints, that roadmap, they're going to – things should be looking pretty rosy.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a way of actually – ramping the relationship up straight away. It's as I said, it's at its most engaged point at that time. You can actually further engage them straight away.
Excellent. Well, enjoy your holiday. Who's in charge while you're away?
Not me.
Me.
Right.
As I mentioned at the start of the show, Touch Football's 900,000 participants was one of the catalysts for a strategic partnership with the National Rugby League. It is a historic sporting partnership representing the biggest boost to participation and game development in the history of either sport. The two sports now work together as the largest sporting community in the country with a combined participation of approximately 1.9 million people. The partnership represents the most significant national marketing and participation drive in Australian sport. And that's why I invited Colm on the show to discuss where Touch Football Australia's commercial program was and what impact the strategic partnership with the NRL has had on Touch Football Australia's commercial program and what it looks like now. Here's my chat with Colm. Colm Maguire, Touch Football Australia CEO, welcome to Inside Sponsorship. Let's start with giving us a little bit of context in terms of the size of the sport, its structure, its governance, and what a typical year looks like, because some of our listeners are from overseas might not be familiar with Touch Football.
Yeah, so Touch Football is a participation sport mainly that runs all year round. It's one of the biggest participation sports in Australia, with 672,000 people playing across the country. Summer seasons generally last around 16 weeks, and then we pause for a little while and go all again into winter. Those brave souls that play in Canberra through the winter is that they're worth their weight in gold. So we have a really strong governance structure, one that you would deem a unified structure, which means that we have a sort of a hybrid model, which brings out a one management model whereby we run and employ staff into a lot of the states in Australia, and then we have a behavioural or a unified collaborative model with our two biggest jurisdictions in New South Wales and Queensland. So it ranges from grassroots participation right through to elite, and our best of the best sort of participate against New Zealand annually.
And the reason I asked you on the show was because Touch Football's recently been through some very significant changes via a strategic alliance with the National Rugby League. Can you explain to us about that in more detail?
Yeah, look, I think as any sport would attest, it's a difficult environment to actually grow in terms of sporting participation, but not just that, the capacity to actually look at your revenues or your sponsorship opportunities, and therefore you've got to collaborate either with your internal partners or your commercial partners. And the opportunity to work with a bigger partner that is aligned in terms of the product, many people would see a very close affinity between rugby league and touch football in terms of the way it's played. So we commenced discussions in 2011 and worked through looking at different ways to integrate and how that could actually come to fruition. And in 2013, we signed a strategic alliance which would align both sports with a view to becoming Australia's largest sporting community by ensuring that there's a place on the field for everyone. I think, you know, not everyone can play NRL at a professional level, but if you actually look at touch football, everyone can play touch football, from the 5-year-old to the 55-year-old, male, female. It's a great participation sport and one that anyone can participate in.
Which is a little bit different and certainly creates a bigger market, particularly when we look at access for sponsors, because it's not like other sports in some other markets where it's very much a funnel that pushes people to the elite, and if you can't make it to the next level, you kind of, your participation drops off.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the strengths that we actually have is the participation base that we have and the actual wide demographic that you're selling to. You're talking to a kid that participates at 5 years old. You're talking to the CEO of a company that's 55, but they've generally been on that journey, whether they've played in other sports or not. They actually enjoy the social aspect of our sport, which a lot of other, sporting codes around the world are actually looking to get into now. They're actually looking at that participation option, whether it's a fast fives game of netball or the, you look at 2020 cricket. There's a whole range of different things, cardio, tennis, that are starting to be put out there to actually get people to participate in different ways.
And the other interesting aspect about touch football is it gives families the ability to participate together because it's non-contact.
Yeah, absolutely. I play in a local competition here with my 10-year-old and my 14-year-old daughter and my wife. So,
and rumour has it that they're better at it than you are.
Yeah. Well, they won. We won the grand final, and truth be told, my daughter got the most valuable player. So that was an interesting outcome, but certainly one that you rock up with a different mindset. I think when you're playing with your family, you can actually go out there and enjoy the participation. And I can see that sort of team staying together for maybe 20 or 30 years. It's not uncommon to hear of families that have played together for 20 years at the park with their best friends, and it's one of those unique propositions that we really feel is important to us.
Yeah, and we'll get into that a little bit more, but certainly in terms of a unique proposition and the family access and culture that the sport presents for people is certainly significant. Now, since that strategic change, I think it's fair to say that Touch Football has made some significant moves forward commercially. Mm-hmm. What are some of the key factors behind those advancements?
Yeah, look, I think one of the major advantages is that we were ready. We were ready to take advantage of those commercial opportunities, and potentially timing ended up being one of those really significantly positive outcomes. But certainly the networks that come to your disposal when you're dealing with a National Rugby League and Touch Football, there are doors that open that wouldn't necessarily have opened previously. So therefore, the networks and the relationships that you're introduced to certainly allow a sport like ours to be positioned or put forward in a different way. But certainly the brand proposition that was put forward, one of the unique elements that we looked at was while we have a strong participation base, the NRL has the profile. So in terms of capturing the profile and linking them to our participant base, well, then brand became central to that. So by creating a brand that aligned both of our organisations and brought them together, we feel now that we've positioned ourselves well for people to know what NRL Touch Football is, and that's the brand that we're uniting behind to actually say this is our participation brand for Touch Football.
But fundamentally, the value proposition of Touch Football, the sport itself, hasn't shifted. What, in hindsight, do you think you could have done to achieve what you've been able to now in the days running under a standalone NSO arrangement?
Yeah, look, the biggest one is we've done a lot of work to become that unified governance model that I talk about. I think if you can actually get organisations to work together, obviously critical mass starts to become one of the key propositions that you can put to a market. So from a sponsorship perspective, all of a sudden, if you do have management control into multiple jurisdictions, you can actually present a bigger offering. You can say, okay, we are in control of delivery into a South Australia, Victoria, Tasmania, as well as the national body. So you're taking an alignment of an NSO and you're pushing it all the way down to what someone sees when they rock up at a local affiliate and participate on the park. So I think sports, if they can achieve that from the unified governance model, is one way to achieve it. But I think that behavioural or cultural element and alignment to actually say that they will work together would bring the biggest outcome.
And do the state-based organisations like that? Do they respond positively to that approach, or do they feel as though people are encroaching on their power base, so to speak?
Yeah, certainly I think early on most people would have indicated that that was going to jeopardise their outcomes, and therefore what they would have looked at was, oh, but we get a $5,000 sponsor or we get a $4,000 sponsor. But the outcome specifically has ended up being that we have got a massive sponsorship in comparison to the small sponsorships that were there before, and we can actually have that ability to push those sponsorships down and show people that there has been a benefit in the long term. But certainly early resistance, I would say, we had to work through. And then as you work through it, you're able to demonstrate the benefits, and as you demonstrate the benefits, the commercial returns have gone up and so on. So it's been a positive outcome all around.
So focusing directly on sponsorship, what's one piece of advice you would give to other NSOs who are trying to achieve sponsorship success that maybe you wish you knew 5 years ago before you'd gone through this transition?
It's an interesting question. Certainly know that I knew it, if that makes sense, but I think relationships are central to success. I think if you have the ability to work through and present those strong relationships and work on those and then actually get the benefit to flow through both ways, I think that's going to be the key outcome. I think that things have changed a great deal in sponsorship over the last 10 years, where it's not one of those areas that you just go and get your money and you basically walk away.
It's not a donation anymore, so to speak, is it?
It's a return on investment. And they very much, what ends up happening is that exactly what we talked about in terms of the collaboration that we're having with the NRL, if you don't approach a sponsorship with a collaborative mindset that we're both going to get benefits of this, out of this relationship, then you're not going to have success. But I think the thing I wish I knew, and we're probably only getting to the point where we have the capacity to do things about it now, is to actually formulate an exact plan about what the properties are. It can't be a reactive science. It can't be something that you wake up in the morning and decide, oh, I'm going to approach someone to be our travel partner. You need to know what your benefits are. You need to know what categories you're selling.
What objectives they help you achieve. You need to know about
your demographics, and then you need to research specifically the partners that align with all of that. So we're currently going to implement a little bit of that work and actually have a look at what our proposition is to market, what the categories are that are available, and then actually do that real research to actually quantify what the value of a sponsorship with us is.
So the NRL had their own, have and did have at the time that the strategic alliance kicked off, had their own sponsors. You had your own sponsors. Were there any clashes where, you know, without putting too fine a point on it, the NRL were a big commercial machine. You were more of a participation sport. So yeah. Were there any sponsors that you sort of had to sort of maybe let drift off into the night?
Yeah, not so much because of the NRL. I think because of the size and scope of the NRL, they've got so many partners. So therefore, a lot of their partners or relationships that we had because of many of the sponsors that Touch Football has were what I call product sponsors. They're aligned to actually taking the field, whether it's your apparel, whether it's your football, whether it's your compression, whether it's your boot. So in respect to the NRL, they end up being licensees. So in most cases, they're either aligned partners or not. I think where we actually made some decisions over the same period was that we believed that the value of our sponsorships through the relationship that we forged with the NRL had actually gone up, that we presented a new opportunity and an expanded and higher benefit opportunity. And when you get into a conversation with sponsors that may on occasions be looking to, I guess, negotiate is yep. probably the easiest word to say. Sometimes you need to stand your ground in terms of what your value to the sponsor is, because they're trying to drive an outcome that meets their need. And if you actually know what it is you're selling and the value that you present to them, the value in our view had gone up and we weren't prepared to accept less. So we would be happy to have no partner in that category and back ourselves in to get a new partner.
And I spoke to Mark about this the other day. I think it might even actually be recorded in this podcast in our earlier section, is that it's important that you control that churn, that yeah. you choose for that sponsor to leave. And if you've got control of your commercial program well and you're not reactive and waking up one day and thinking, we'll go and chase this person.
Yeah.
If you stand your ground, you have control, you choose to let that sponsor go, not them knock on your door one day and go, you know what, we're not getting value out of this, we're not going to renew.
Yeah, look, and I think a lot of those retail partners or partners that have retailing agencies, it can be very difficult to manage a sponsorship because they have different relationships in terms of saying, well, we can't see that we're selling directly to your market, but then they can't run quantifiable evidence into a provider to say that a Touch person came in and bought the product. All we can do is look at the return on the way that things are occurring or what we see. So, look, I think it's a pretty valuable learning for us, but again, timing was excellent. We signed a major partner through our relationship with the NRL. Our sponsorship element was covered off to a degree in terms of an increase, and we were certainly willing to let it walk. It doesn't mean that revenue isn't missed. It certainly is, but I think in the long term it'll be rejuvenated, and we'll find a partner that meets with our values and meets with the direction we're going.
We often hear that only those organisations with big TV deals can attract big name sponsors. In your case, that isn't necessarily true. How did you settle on your own unique selling proposition, considering the arrangements?
Yeah, I think this is the critical point. We certainly aren't a television product because of the investment element or because of the awareness. Currently, I think the way that things are changing in terms of the ability to reach people through social media, through databases, through EDMs, again, perfect timing for us. We set a strategic objective to fix our database. We prioritised data in our participation plan, which was unheard of in 2010. and certainly saw that the commercial returns could be realised by actually ensuring we knew more about our participants, could communicate with them and could articulate who they were. So we certainly believe we have one of the best databases in sport. So in terms of a unique selling proposition that we have, we can talk to our members from a national body all the way down. There's no gatekeepers. We are the custodians of all data, and therefore we can talk directly to our market, or we can test different things. We can basically work with them, but it's a participation sport. So then when you're talking to a sponsor, you're talking about talking to a parent of a child who actually participates as well as taking their child to a participate. Mm. So it's actually a pretty strong or affluent market in terms of the people that participate in touch football. So we certainly have a pretty strong demographic in that area as well.
From a marketing perspective, it's growing your own audience and having the ability to actually communicate with them is clearly an important marketing goal.
Mm-hmm.
But from a sport perspective, it actually puts you in a really strong position because that's valuable to a sponsor. They want to be able to talk to the people that participate in your sport.
Absolutely. And look, in recent times, we're starting to have conversations with partners and sponsors that are purely interested in an EDM release, and you can actually quantifiably value what that costs you to actually send out, what you believe the participant reach to be, and then talk to them about a per person rate for the exposure that they're having. I think a lot of sponsors are now looking at that element of the sponsorship as a communication tool, and that sort of communication tool is starting to replace TV advertising. It's starting to replace things they may do on a billboard, because they know they can reach an expanded database very, very quickly. And if they can pitch alignment with a sport they love and create that emotional attachment, well, then you've got a real hook to actually sell.
So you communicate with your database through email, through social. Is there any hard copy mail or SMS, or is that something you're looking to grow into? Do you do much of it?
Yeah, not so much anymore. Look, I'd probably be as honest as I can here, is that, you know, this is an area we need to improve in. We certainly know what we have to do, but we're not doing it well enough yet. And I think that's one of these other advantages we can actually look at with the NRL, but we can also look at it with third-party providers. We do have in-house capability, but in-house capability can only go so far. So, you know, you want the EDM to be designed, you know, you want it to go out with regularity, but then operational elements take control of it and you don't hit the market as quickly as you would like or as regularly as you would like. So certainly to my team, I'm laying down the challenge over this next cycle that we've done the hard work to get the information. Now what we need to do is implement the tools that actually present a professional front to what we've done.
And some of that innovation and changes about how you do it can be driven by either an existing sponsor, or a sponsor comes on board and says, we're really invested in hard copy mail. Can we use your database to do that?
So, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So from a governing body point of view, what do you see as your role from a sponsorship management perspective for your state bodies and affiliated clubs?
Yeah, there's a whole range of things here because of the way that we're set up. Obviously, there's a support role, and there's definitely a leadership role in terms of acquisition of partners on behalf of that group, but setting standards in terms of delivery and looking at the fact that we can't have competing partners, and so we really work hard on not underselling. And I think in some of the state bodies, what we found in the past is that they will sell the farm, so to speak, for $5,000 to a pub, and I don't mean that disrespectfully. We'll take any pub's money, but realistically, what it does mean is that if you oversell because you really need that cash, then you're undervaluing partners up the chain or capacity to actually talk to partners up the chain, because it ends up fragmented. So there's a leadership role to that, and certainly an accountability one. So from our perspective, the two elements that I would say from a national model we play. We play a support role, but we also play a compliance role and ensure that standards are met all the way through the sport, so that a partner can walk into a South Australian competition and see exactly what they see in a Victorian competition or a national competition. It's critically important to us to ensure that they're happy and they understand it, because you never know, particularly with a major partner, say, for instance, like Harvey Norman, there are such a wide network of stores across Australia, you never ever know when you're actually having the CEO of a local or a local franchisee actually walking past your competition, which is our shopfront.
Or participating in your competition.
Exactly right, and that's our shopfront.
Because nobody from Harvey Norman is participating at the elite level in the NRL, so it's a different dynamic there,
absolutely,
isn't it?
And look, I used this today at a annual meeting that I was at. We've got a very, very strong affinity and fan avidity with the NRL because people feel that our sport is the one that they can play. They can't necessarily play rugby league, so there's the ability to build that brand association. And there was a video clip that was released on Friday last week promoting our Trans-Tasman through the NRL network. By Sunday morning, it had 400,000 views across the world. Like, it wasn't contained locally. It was actually, it went broad. Now, from a sponsor's perspective, that's incredible coverage that they got immediately, but we don't necessarily know who's looking at it.
Mm.
So if we had have done shortcuts on what sort of branding we had on it, or we didn't put the sponsor's brand at the back end of it, certainly wouldn't have the cut through that we all want.
That interesting dynamic of a sponsor not just walking past a competition on a Wednesday night, but potentially even participating in the sport. Does it scare you, or is it a really positive opportunity for them to immerse themselves in the sport and see how their brand, because not many sponsors would actually experience from their own sponsorship from a participation point of view?
Yeah, look, it's a really fantastic point, and one that I have to commend Harvey Norman in particular around that. Katie Page, through her leadership, wanted to see her employees being active and actually engaging in the product and actually build a stronger affinity with the product being touch football. Therefore, one of the propositions that we sold into the sponsorship was the opportunity for local franchises to put in teams into the local competitions. What that did was build local relationships. So all of a sudden, the local store is building a affinity with what occurs at the park, building a relationship with the local affiliate, and there was no barriers as to what occurs from there. So we've had...
And they're embedding themselves into the community further.
Absolutely. So local associations have had opportunities to do fundraiser barbecues at a Harvey Norman store, right through to prizes. You know, I was lucky enough to witness a prize being donated to the South Australian clubs of a television to raise money for a girl that had recently been, in a major accident. So I think once you start to get that sort of link at a local level, as well as two organisations working at the top level, I think that's critically important. And I think that's going to, while scary, because you do have the odd email that says we had a bad experience, and if I, again, be honest, which is my way, some sleepless nights in the first 12 months of our relationship with a brand that's as big and as wide and diverse as that. But we've got to back our capability to get over those issues and ensure that they have a positive experience.
And what helps you get over those issues is that whole, we overuse this word, but it's super important, is the partnerships. Because you've got, from what you just said, you've got a partnership from a team participating in a local affiliated competition right through to two logos on a video sitting next to each other that 400,000 people around the world saw.
Yeah.
And the sponsor's ability to be able to email you and say, we didn't necessarily have a great experience, is actually a reflection of a good relationship, because they say, we care about what happens and the experience, and we want to let you know so that you can fix it up.
Look, absolutely. And I think from that perspective, the interaction's been really good. We've had a view that this is a long-term proposition in its first, iteration of development. So certainly for the first 12 to 18 months, we've been working out what the capacity is, what the issues are, and looking to overcome them. And again, it is a relationship. It's something that you've got to continue to work on. You are going to have situations where people aren't happy. You're going to have situations where they're extremely happy. But if you can actually simplify the relationship, or simplify the whole agreement down to a relationship, and I know we've had this conversation once before about comparing, a sponsorship contract to a relationship, as deep even as a marriage. Like, you are in something that you've both committed to. There's going to be things that you need to understand the partner can or can't do, things that they want to do, things that they're not able to do yet. But certainly work with them to ensure that you're both getting what you need out of the relationship.
Mm. And the other interesting dynamic, as I was listening to you there, is that I'm sure there's a bunch of sponsorship and commercial managers that are listening to this podcast going, geez, I wish some of my sponsors had let me know if they weren't necessarily happy halfway through the relationship rather than at renewal time.
Yeah, and look, I think that's critically important. If you're constantly in the dialogue and managing the relationship, you know where the pain points are. And if you can actually identify and show intent, and I think intent Absolutely. Is the main thing, if you show intent to resolve the issue, then you build up trust. If you build up trust and transparency, whether it's issue, positive, issue, negative, you've got a good relationship. And I think that's as simple as it can be. Take what you know in life to be right and apply it to what you're doing with your partnerships and relationships.
I agree 100%. So touch football has one of the highest participation rates of any sport in Australia across all generations. What role do you see technology playing in making you a more attractive sponsorship proposition?
Yeah, look, it's immense. We had this conversation only yesterday with my leadership team. Again, it's one of those battles I think that you constantly get into as an emerging sport or a sport that doesn't have the capacity to invest, and that would be no different to any business. You sit and you look at technology and go, I can spend X amount of dollars on technology, but I don't have that money. Well, I think the time has come that if you don't invest, you won't have any money. So I think from our perspective, we certainly know that we need to get professionals in to have a look at what our IT capability is first and foremost, where we need to be, and make the recommendation. We've certainly got people that can manage the journey. We don't necessarily have all the skills or the ability to identify absolutely everything we need. So I think those businesses or sports that aren't moving to advance themselves in a technological way now are going to be the ones that are struggling in 5 to 6 years' time.
And a stronger business on all fronts, not just the technology front, make you way more attractive when a sponsor comes and first has interactions with you.
Yeah, absolutely, because you can start to talk about how you push out messages, what sort of delivery you have, the mechanisms that you have to get to market, and how you actually communicate. So I think they're the sorts of things that everyone's interested in now. And certainly from our perspective, we're constantly talking about our engagement, how often we're talking to our customers. I heard today, again, 800,000 views per month, like we're trying to hit at the moment. We're targeting 1 million. So it's one of those things that if you don't set the metrics, you're not going to achieve them. So you've got to know the products that are going to take you to the market in the right way.
What exciting things have you got planned for the sport?
Well, we've just launched been in a consultative process for our next strategic cycle. We had a pretty ambitious plan through to 2015, which we paused and celebrated, which I think is really important to do in any business, is to actually reflect on the achievements. But what we've done is we've set aggressively ambitious targets for the next 5 years. So we want to have 1 million participants. We want to ensure that we're investing back into the sport. We certainly want to grow our social media and database presence. And we'll be looking to diversify the way that we present our sport. Franchising, licensing, those sorts of elements are going to give us more control, more capability to present all the way down to grassroots the way it should be, and give cut through all the way down to the bottom of our participation model. So that's certainly going to be an exciting proposition to actually invest in.
And is that another 5-year plan? Was the last one 5 years?
Yeah. So we're through to 2020. So from this year through to 2020. And look, it's going to be an exciting journey. And junior development and school participation is one of the big opportunities we have as well. So that's one that is really exciting for us. And certainly from a sponsorship perspective, we're looking at it and saying, well, the sport's now prepared to invest. We didn't have that capacity or capital to invest previously. We've built a solid base in our equity. Now what we're going to do is take some risks around how we're going to invest. And it's incredible how quickly the tide turns when you say, okay, well, we're going to invest in a school ambassador program, which puts shirts on people going into the schools, talking to them about our sport 4 or 5 times a year. We'll give schools this, that, and the other. How quickly you have people put up their hand and say, oh, we might be interested in that. So sometimes it takes that brave step to actually create the product. in order to have a sponsor come to it and then support it. You can't sell a dream all the time. So we're backing our capability to develop something, and then hopefully from the commercial return aspect, we'll have partners jumping on board with some of these things that we're creating.
And clearly a strong base and the equity allows you to take some risks. Do you think that makes you attractive to a sponsor when you say, we're going to go and give this a go, and a sponsor goes, I think we could see that working?
It should. It definitely should give them confidence, because we certainly feel that our track record over the last 5 years certainly shows that the risks and the direction that we've gone, we actually deliver on. So I think if we're saying that we're going to commit ourselves to something, we are going to achieve it. We've been aggressively ambitious, and we will continue to be. And we've got to approach things with a limitless mindset and a fearless mentality. And if we can do that, I think there's plenty of businesses that have grown astronomically themselves based on the same sort of attitudes. So there's a good cultural alignment in terms of getting on board with an organization that wants to go forward.
Mm, I agree. If people want to get in touch with you or get on board, and they want to find out more about Touch Football Australia, what can they do?
Look, there's now, based on what we've just talked about, there's 1,000 ways to stay in touch with us. So
just head to your local Harvey Norman store.
Yeah. You can go into a Harvey Norman store. You can visit touchfootball.com.au. You can get on Facebook. You can go to Twitter. Last week we launched Snapchat. Like, there are so many avenues to market, but you know what? If you actually want to like go old school, you can actually pick up the phone. I'm sure you could find a phone number, or even who knows, people might even choose to pay us a visit every once in a while.
Yes, yeah, very good. Colin Maguire, Touch Football Australia CEO, thank you so much for taking us inside the commercial program of Touch Football Australia.
My pleasure.
Well, there have certainly been some significant changes in the commercial program at Touch Football Australia, and thanks again to Colin for taking some time out of his very busy schedule to share some stories and insights with us. I can tell you that he came straight from the airport to the office to record that chat, so it is very much appreciated. Now, a big shout out to Dustin Gonzalez, Senior Associate Strategic Partnership at the New York Racing Association. He's in the middle of a very busy season with the Belmont Stakes coming up in a few weeks, but he still shot me an email saying he is loving the show. So thanks for the kind words, Dustin. And I will be looking to have you on the show soon, and you can take us inside the commercial program of the New York Racing Association. If you want to connect with me, then you can do so on LinkedIn. Just search for Daniel Oyston, or drop me an email at daniel@sponserve.net. If you are liking the show or have some suggestions or topics or maybe an idea for a guest, then be sure to get in touch and I'll give you a shout out and see what we can do about it all. If you've got any complaints or hate mail, send that stuff direct to mark@sponserve.net. He absolutely loves it. If you aren't already, be sure to subscribe to all our content so we can get it straight into your inbox. Simply head to any of our blogs or podcasts at sponserve.net and fill in the subscription form, and we'll deliver that content to your inbox each and every week. Of course, if you've got 2 minutes and you love the show, then be sure to head to iTunes and leave us a quick review. It makes a huge difference in helping others discover the show, so we'd really, really appreciate it. Until next time, I'm Daniel Oyston. Thanks for listening to Inside Sponsorship.
Thanks for listening to the show. For more episodes, blogs, and resources, head to sponserve.net. Or search for Sponserve on Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn.